You're listening to Economics of Place, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Dan Gilmartin.
Welcome back to another edition of the Economics of Place podcast. I'm Dan Gilmartin, the Executive Director and CEO of the Michigan Municipal League. And we're coming to you today from the Michigan Municipal League's Capital Conference in Lansing, where we have about 600 local officials from all over Michigan, from the UP, from Detroit, from sort of everywhere in between, meeting to talk about issues of relevance to local communities, to downtowns, to housing, clean water, you name it. We're discussing it here in Lansing. So I'm joined for this podcast by two very special guests. The first is making a return visit to the podcast, this time as sort of the co-host of this podcast, and that is Melanie Piana. Melanie is the current board president of the Michigan Municipal League. She's also a council member in the city of Ferndale. So, Melanie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Great. And our other guest today is someone who just finished speaking on the main stage, Jennifer Nichols, who is the Assistant Director of Research, Interpretation, and Application at the Frameworks Institute, where she trains thousands of advocates and policy experts to frame their issues more effectively in fields ranging from child development to aging. And having just listened to Jennifer for the better part of an hour or so, I was fascinated with a lot of what she talked about. I know, Melanie, you were too, regarding how to speak to people, how we don't do a very good job of that anymore in society. And we thought we'd grab Jennifer and let her talk to our audience, talk more about that. So Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So just first off, tell us about your work in general. Why is this a thing? Why is framing discussions a thing for local officials, for just people in society in 2019?
Sure. Well, I think because everyone talks all day long. I mean, we all communicate in one way or another, whether we're writing or talking or what have you. I think there's a tendency to assume that that's all there is to it. You just say what's on your mind, and that's communicating. And it is a kind of communication, but we know enough now about how our brains work to understand that we process information in ways that are counterintuitive to what we think may be happening when we put a message out into the world. There's not a one-to-one direct transmission. So you put a message into the world, but there's something that it has to flow through before it lands in the minds of the people around you who you're talking with, and that's culture. And culture really shapes the way we think about the world. It builds up our expectations about how the world works. And all of those things get embedded in our brains and the neural pathways we use to process information. And that means that when you put a message out into the world, the cues that are in that message can often be interpreted in ways that don't accord with what it is you want people to understand about your issue. And so taking time to discover what strategies are most effective for communicating can make you a better communicator and help you cut through the noise of culture and the assumptions and biases that all of us bring to any issue. You know, we're not alone in the public square. There's lots of other stories out there, and your story is competing with everyone else's.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. You showed a short video of a bunch of shapes. If I recall, there were two triangles of different size, a circle, even smaller, and a big square with something that opened that looked kind of like a door. And they just sort of looked like amoebas rolling around the screen. And afterwards, you asked everybody in the audience, did they see a story? And every hand went up. Yeah. And everybody saw something different. And they had basically concocted their own feature-length movie out of these objects moving around for maybe 30 seconds or so. I don't know how long that was. That shows us about sort of our implicit nature in terms of how we see the world and what we assign. We assign gender to that. We assigned all kinds of authority. And everyone's saying, well, it's one of the triangles was bullying the other triangle, all kinds of different stuff going on. That's really what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that we make a lot of assumptions about how the world works. And we do that by design. It's not a flaw in our brains. Our brains are created that way because there's tons of information coming at us all the time. And so we have a way of processing information really quickly and efficiently. The problem is the processor it may be efficient, but that doesn't mean it's accurate. So there's an economist, Daniel Kahneman, who's written a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, and he's known for talking about the ways our minds work as working on two systems, system one and system two. And system one is that quick, frugal processor of information. And system two is where our deep thinking and more critical engagement with issues happens. It's just that system one tends to leap up. It's just that system one tends to leap up and really get in the way of our deep critical engagement because it's so concerned with processing information quickly. And if we can choose cues in our framing and in our messaging that shuts down system one so we can get at people's system two and invite them to really think more critically about an issue and more deeply, we have a better chance of getting through and having real dialogue about how problems work and what the solutions are. It's just difficult to get past that system one. And that's what you saw operating in that video that I showed with the circles and triangles moving around on the screen. Everybody's system one was hard at work trying to make sense of something that you really couldn't make sense of. So that's what your audience is doing. If you're a communicator, you're putting a message out into the world. And if you don't take the time to fill in all of the steps of that story for your audience, they're going to do it for you, and you just don't know what story they're going to fill in.
I thought your presentation was fantastic today. Gave some great tips to local officials about how to approach some of the changes they're seeing being asked by their community members to put in place, but may not exactly know how to move forward in order to do that in the most effective way. And so I think during the planning process of how are we going to implement this policy, how are we going to address this crisis, how are we going to, get support from the community on this new project, it really is coming down to the reasons why an investment or something needs to change. And my experience for the past 10 years in Ferndale, the importance of spending time on communications and figuring out what are the needs that the residents and businesses have to learn about a particular issue that is bubbling up in the community. And a lot of cities don't have the resources to spend time to think through like you're asking or teaching communities to do. One of the changes I've seen, when I got onto council, we didn't have a communications director. And now we do, and we have two communications staffers. And our ability to be more timely and learn what is making, is having a, impact in the community. And let me give you an example. Snow removal or snow plowing is a big deal. And everybody loves it, but they don't like it when cars park on the street and want people to remove their cars, but they also
want it magically to go away.
When the snow plow comes through and actually plows snow onto people's driveways, clears the streets, but creates this secondary problem of you have more snow to clear from your driveway. And that's just the nature of snow removal. And what we've learned is that if we are more upfront about the expectations of the snow emergency, in teaching people about snow emergencies, because it's not, you're always doing it every winter. You start over again every winter because people move in and out. They may not know about snow emergencies and they don't know what to do. And so, but framing it up, we said, hey, please remove your streets so you don't get a ticket. And now we're like, be neighborly. Be neighborly and do the right thing to remove your car so that the cops, we don't want to ticket you.
Yeah.
But
the goal is not the ticket. The goal is the snow to be gone.
Yeah,
so that
exactly.
You can be happier.
And the process to learn that was a lot of listening to the community and then reframing what the purpose of it is. And then we came up with a video and we put it out every time now there's a snow emergency that we think might happen because of the weather predictions.
Right.
And so to me, that is how I took your lessons from today and applied it to a real world situation in Ferndale of how we tended to figure it out. And I think that's the process for every community of going through of like, we've got this problem that we need to address in our community. And you said, just don't lead with the problem, you also have to lead with the solution. And that is, I think the approach that cities really need to take a look at. And I think many of them already do that, but they may not have the communication specialists at their disposal to do that. And I think that's where some of the cities are like, well, this is great, but now what? You know, how do we augment some of these things?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting example because so I heard a lot of what a lot in what you just said. And the first thing I heard is that it is true that communications often come at the end of a process or a project, but really they need to start at the beginning. How are you going to start building support from the start for the thing that you're trying to accomplish? And that sometimes it can require resources, but sometimes it just requires all being on the same page about what your talking points are, and really making sure that that's part of the plan. The second thing I heard was that you switched from a really problem-oriented messaging strategy, you're going to get a ticket if you don't do this thing, to a collective value. It's about being neighborly. So it's about what's at stake. It's about tapping it. Nobody wants to be accused of not being a good neighbor. It makes you sound like a bad person. So appealing to people's sense of neighborliness, I want other people to treat me in a neighborly way, that's really taking the issue out from the personal, individual, you're going to get a ticket because you did something wrong, to we're all in this together. We've got to work together. We're a community. And elevating it from a me conversation to a we conversation, which is really helpful. And then the third thing you said is that every year you bring these messages out and you really focus on repetition. Framing is not just about knowing what to say. It's also about saying it over and over and over again, because it's not only about snow removal. It's also that if you instill in people and really build up a strong sense of neighborliness in your community through that messaging, you're setting yourself up for better solutions for the next battle you might be waging. So because you're shifting people's dominant mindset from one of that bad person did this thing and it's really interrupting me, to we all have an obligation, including myself, to be neighborly. And that carries over from just a snow removal conversation to the ways they approach every community issue. So you're helping frame not only for right now, but also for the future. So it sounds like you did a really smart framing job there.
It's taken time to learn that, though, and we now have a process internally in the city with our communications director, and we do communications planning, and it has really made a difference, I think, for not only city staff, but also the residents of business, and they expect higher quality communications coming out of the city now, and I think that's a good thing.
It makes sense. The other thing is, by putting more resources and attention and time into that, if you aren't participating in the public square, if you aren't there telling your story and trying to make sure that story is the dominant one, other people are. And so you end up in a space where your views aren't represented. So you have to be part of the communications process. And I think public agencies and nonprofits have been a little slow to that game, partly because of the resource question you raise, but are catching up to it now and understanding that we really have to participate in public conversation to shift it and shape it. If we don't, we have lots of evidence of what can go wrong if we don't.
We're talking with Jennifer Nichols from the Frameworks Institute, who just finished a very fascinating and informing talk on the main stage here at the Michigan Municipal League Capital Conference. And Jennifer, Let's talk about the elephant in the room. People just don't communicate very well anymore. And I've heard it described so many different ways. We've become tribalism. It's all kinds of different things. And I'm guessing you have some ideas about why, if someone considers themselves a Republican, if a Democrat walks in the room and says, I'm here to help, it's like, we don't want you. If you're from the city, the suburbs are bad. If you're whatever, if you're from business and government couldn't possibly come to help us or whatever it is, it's like we just sort of shut off and interpret probably too soon what's going on, and we shut down that conversation. Is that, in listening, is that part of that process, one part of the conversation, that's my thought, but why is that, do you think? Is that just, we've gotten away from everything Melanie was just talking about be a good neighbor, and instead the relationship is, in your case, was the homeowner's relationship with the big bad government. You know, they're here to ticket me. And instead, it's, no, be a good neighbor. Your neighbor has to get to work. They have to get their kids to school. Just pay attention.
Sure. Well, I think that the Michigan Municipal League is in an interesting position because you're focusing on local government and local relationships. And that right now is where a lot of the power lies in making change, I think, especially in this national moment where it seems like conversations are fractious and contentious. But one-on-one individual relationships are a little different than that. They work differently from that. One of the strategies we advise people is to get away from partisan categorization, to move away from naming teams, because as soon as you reinforce in people's minds what team you're on or give yourself a label, they've already made up their mind about whatever
you're
it is you're going
bad,
to say.
Right?
That's right. So instead, using things like a unifying value can still tap into people across the political spectrum and help them engage in those kinds of dialogues. Explanation and talking about how systems work can pull people away from thinking about how people work and how individuals work, because our, especially in American culture, our dominant model for thinking about problems and solutions is what individual is responsible, or what is it about that person that's different from me that's allowed this situation to arise for them that hasn't arisen for me. And that just feeds people's biases and assumptions about each other. So if you can move the conversation away from talking about people and specifically individuals, and instead focus it on a system or a structure or a process or a mechanism, you're more likely to be able to engage people across differences, because they're not looking at each other, they're now looking together at this third thing that, you know, they're focusing their attention somewhere else. So I think those conversations are possible to have. I also think that some of the framing that we're seeing in the media right now, it's not new necessarily, it's just heightened.
Yeah,
and it's heightened for
exactly.
But the same strategies that have worked in the past can work now. We just have to really employ them consistently with repetition over time and be committed to a unifying strategy. And I think this we'll see this cycle kind of ebb and flow as we have in the past.
Mm-hmm. I go back to local government is nonpartisan. And that is an area to build bridges. And I know lots of local officials ran for office to improve their communities. And that is really the starting point for a conversation. And, you know, we always hear garbage is not Republican or Democrat. Garbage pickup is not, right?
Potholes.
Potholes aren't either. And that's really true. And so how do we focus on building bridges on the issues and opportunities that the community really cares about? And I think that's where I have had, you know, the most enjoyment in my public service role, because by identifying those problems with the community, you're also identifying solutions and figuring out together with the community engagement that we do in Ferndale and that a lot of communities are doing, is where what is the right path to go forward on implementing that solution. And I feel like we have done that particularly well in Ferndale. We have definitely had our stumbles and failures, but we have a continuous improvement mindset in Ferndale. And so we always say, what are the lessons learned from this and how can we improve going forward? So I always go back to what is the, you know, role of local government, and that is to protect the community, solve problems, and make a great place to live.
And it's a place, it's local government is a place where you actually know your leaders on a personal basis.
Right.
You know, in my neighborhood back in D.C., my advisor neighborhood commissioner lives two doors down from me, and I can knock on her door and say, hey, what's going on with that pothole? And we have a lot of them in D.C. right now because of our bad winter, but she's there, and it's a kind of relationship that's a little harder to have at a larger level. And so you have some opportunities not only to think about your framing, which everyone has opportunities to think about, but also to enact those conversations in ways that are very personal, and to really build the kinds of interpersonal relationships, nonpartisan relationships that can push a conversation forward. And it's a lot harder to look someone in the eye and think of them as some sort of monster because they're on the opposite spectrum politically than it is to vilify someone online, for example.
Right. Yeah, the email muscles people get, or the online muscles they get when they become tough guys and girls on Twitter and Facebook and everything. You'd never do that in person.
Yeah, the online courage.
Yeah, it's amazing to watch. But
right.
Biggest mistake you see folks make when they're communicating in a crowd, maybe a local official trying to push an issue, maybe somebody in business, school, whatever. But my guess is the problems get repeated across sectors.
Yeah, so there are a few. I think that the one we see most often is that desire to say why the other person or the other viewpoint is wrong.
Is wrong, right.
But when you do that, you're just reinforcing the other viewpoint, because by repeating it, you're driving it deeper and deeper into people's automatic recall, and that's unhelpful to you. So that's one. I think the other thing is crisis messaging, especially from a government perspective. If you're walking around saying this system is broken, you know, this everything is broken, this is terrible, but the people and the entities and the organizations who have to fix it are also the same people who you're saying are responsible for having broken it in the first place, so government on both sides, you're not helping your cause. If you want to build people's trust in government to fix problems, to be there to protect them from problems, you can't on one hand say the system is broken, government can't, you know, hasn't done its job, and then on the other say government's going to solve this for you. You have to say instead something like, look, the system doesn't work for what we need it to do now. At some point it made sense to do this. It doesn't make sense to do this anymore. We've got to update it. We have to revisit how it's working and make it work for us. And we can do that because citizens have the opportunity to participate in government in that way. We all need to be in this together.
How about your best piece of advice for people and how to deal with others? I mean, it'd probably not to do what you just said, but beyond that, sort of the proactive side, if somebody's listening to this and it has a big issue, they want to go out there and get some support on or turn some people's minds around on, what's the number one thing they should do?
Answer the three big questions and keep your focus on collective engagement. So the three big questions are, what's at stake in this issue? Or another way to think about it is, why should I care about this issue? The second is, how does this issue work? Make sure you break down the processes at play and steer clear of blaming individuals. Talk about what is the system doing, how can it be fixed, and how can you make it work better? And then finally, explain to people, give them a concrete explanation of the solution and how that solution is going to make things better. People need those three big questions answered, because if they're not experts on the issue, that's information they need to be able to come along with you for the kinds of goals that you're striving to achieve.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I noticed in your talk earlier is sort of the difference between an emotional connection and a fact-based connection. If we do this, we'll create 4 million jobs or something like that is different than, hey, we want to make this a better place to live and everyone's going to walk around the streets happy, and just sort of try to connect with somebody a little bit differently, and how facts sometimes actually don't help your cause. Even if they're on your side, they hurt them because you take people into that different place that allows them to sort of hide behind numbers or whatever. That was interesting to me, and something I probably guilty of myself from time to time, or maybe every day.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency among advocates to say the best argument will win. And if we've marshaled all the evidence, that's going to prove our point, and everybody will have an epiphany and think just like we do. But that's just not how our brains work. You have to engage people by tapping into some common thing that you share. And for us, that usually means a value. So everyone wants to be neighborly, for example, on some level, right? That you start there instead of talking about the snow removal or the 4 million jobs or whatever. It's not that facts don't matter. It's just that they may not be the best entry into the conversation. And you can boost your points with facts, but that can't be the whole story. It's got to be deeper than that.
Food for thought, huh, Melanie?
I agree with all of what you just said, and I think I'd like to add the opportunity for cities to use humor as a way to convey the messaging. And we've seen that work particularly well online, where a lot of this information that's coming out of the city is shared. We're a particularly high-use Facebook community, And so we
some of the best Twitter feeds are police chiefs.
Our police chiefs
who are
yeah.
having just being nuts is very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. Well, let me. That's what I thought of when you said that.
I'm gonna go back to Snow. Last year, I was like to our communications director. I was like, you know, I've been wanting to Rickroll my community for a while, which is, you know, Rick Astley, a video from the 80s. And on a particular snow day, we had 5 snowplows on our major row, like one right behind each other. And I'm like, I would love to showcase this service to our community in a different way. And she put the music behind this video, and we Rickrolled our community. And it was highly shared. And so here's this using humor and making fun of ourselves and some, you know, of highlighting a community service that is benefiting. And rather than say 5 snow trucks are out plowing streets today, we just showed them and put music behind it. And that was it.
Yeah.
And that's perhaps all you need to do is to reframe.
Much better than a one-page flyer being put in every mailbox
about
explaining
snow, yeah,
it, exactly,
yeah,
which no one would read, and those who would be mad about
exactly.
it anyway.
Exactly.
To make it fun. So Frameworks has identified 12 what we call frame elements that together compose a frame. So those are the 12 choices you typically make in any particular communication. And one of those choices is tone. And what is your tone? And we know that a crisis tone, which is really hot, over-emotional, really rhetorical, tends to depress people's support for an issue. But a really cold tone can do the same thing, where it's just fact-based. There's no sense of, I see you, people. I see we're all human here. Let's work together. But a warm tone can do that. Something engaging and fun is optimistic. It's lighthearted, but also can still contain important information and serious information, too. I think that's a great strategy.
I think every community approaches every problem differently. One-size-fits-all communications approach does not work for every issue. A crisis needs a different type of crisis communications than about a development project or about a public service, like leaf pickup and recycling. And so you really just need to be very thoughtful at the beginning, again, going back and doing this and figuring out what is the right tone, what would really help the community grasp the new concept or what we're asking them to do differently at the end of the day. And I think just being thoughtful up front and giving space to city staff to help develop that is really what a city council person's role is to do, is say, hey, we have this issue. We will be the spokespeople because that's our role. But please go help figure this out. And whatever you need, the resources you need to address that, we'll try to get them for you, whether it's a marketing firm, a communications specialist. Because I think we've relied on a lot of city staff to be everything sometimes. And in certain situations, you may need some outside help. And I think it's okay for cities to say, perhaps we need a communication specialist if we don't have one because we're so tiny, we don't have a full-time job for that type of role, is how do we go get it so that we are more successful communicating this high-priority project or issue,
yeah.
Right? And I think that's where cities can start making some changes and leveraging this work that you've shared with us today into moving forward.
Sure. I think that it's really important to think, too, that there are two different pieces to communication. There's the strategy behind it. So what is the message? What is it you need people to understand? And what are the tools you can use, whether it's a metaphor to explain something or a particular messenger, to make sure that gets rolled out and people understand it. So whatever you communicate is really taken in and interpreted in the way you want it to be. And then there's the tactical part, right, which is how are we going to disseminate it? Are the folks in our community using social media? Is that how we should reach them? Should we be reaching them through other ways? And which ways are the most effective? So you have to have those two things working in tandem. I'll mention, too, that we have a lot of research on Frameworks' website. It's not behind a paywall. We're a nonprofit, and we've done this research so that everybody working on a particular social issue has access to the same tools. Because one of the things we know is that framing works by repetition. And if you have more people using the same strategy, so across your community, if you've got everybody working on housing, using the same kinds of strategies to talk about housing, then that means that everyone in your community is going to be exposed to that way of thinking about housing wherever they go to have those conversations, wherever they're getting their information from. So if it's helpful for your audience, we have research reports and toolkits yeah. on our website that are all available for anybody working the issue. You can yeah. just go
and
to our
website. The
website
address is?
The website address is frameworksinstitute.org. And you can go search by issue area, whether you're talking about housing or education or age-friendly communities, criminal justice reform, you name it. We've probably done research on it. And it could be helpful. It could give you some resources that you don't have to go out and purchase for yourself. They're there, and you can figure out how to adopt them to and adapt them to your right. particular communication yeah, situation.
It's fascinating stuff. The research is fascinating. The presentation of it is very interesting, and it's something I think we've all got to get better at, those of us in positions to frame issues and to go out there and advocate on behalf of things, whether it's at a local issue or a statewide or even a federal issue. One last question, and you've kind of talked around this a couple times in the answers, but framing an issue for an individual versus maybe a small group of homeowners or downtown businesses or something versus a wide, vast, statewide campaign or something, different or a lot of the principles the same?
A lot of the principles are the same. So when Frameworks does our research, we're often testing things on a national level. So we do nationally representative, large-scale experiments. But we also go into cities and rural places across the country intentionally to talk with people on the streets. It's one of our data collection methods. And we do interviews, long-form, one-on-one, 2 to 3 hour-long interviews with people who are from diverse backgrounds and who are from diverse places in the country to make sure that the strategies we're devising work across all kinds of demographic groups. And we'll work with small municipalities or a city or a state sometimes. And we often hear, well, we think that the strategies are just going to be really different here because our population is so different.
I know.
And every community is different in some ways. What's not different is the way our brains work. We all process information the same way. And on some level, we're all exposed to a dominant culture. Right. So, for example, American individualism, kind of like the pull yourself up by your bootstraps, rugged individualism, that is something that you can't spend an hour on American soil without hearing.
Right.
It's just something that's so deeply part of our culture. We all know it. We all hear it. And so framing strategies to help shift people away from defaulting to this problem is some other individual's fault, and therefore they have to come up with a solution. It's not a public problem and not a public solution that's needed. Works in whatever community you find yourself in.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
Well, you mentioned the playbooks on the Frameworks Institute website, and I brought up earlier when I introduced you the affordable housing framework playbook and the rugged individualism in there related to housing was really insightful. And how do you move away from that when you're saying that we need housing for everyone, as there is a national housing crisis on, and some of the cities in Michigan are feeling it in very acute ways? And I just thought that was like, oh, of course, that makes sense. And I started to shift what I had been saying, and then I sent it on to the playbook on to city staff, and I'm like, we need to leverage this. So I think the resources that your institute provides are amazing, and I'm going to encourage cities across Michigan to go take a look, because it's very relevant to the change that we're trying to push in placemaking and creating great places in Michigan.
Yep. Yeah, and I think the funny thing, and maybe not so funny thing, is that conversation as Americans we have of sort of the rugged individualism versus the collectivist ideology is the right public debate to be having. It's the one we've been having for close to 300 years, if we're being honest. It's something the framers argued with. It's something we
Hamilton
started
and Jeffersonian.
Absolutely. And somehow we've began to demonize each other. And we probably always did to a certain... You read back in some of the history books and Yeah. Folks were doing some pretty underhanded stuff back in the day too, but that conversation of it, is it about me and my world and my family and my job, and or is it about sort of this greater good? Is the sort of American conversation, always has been, always will be, but man, has it devolved into a middle school food fight at this point in time. So maybe we could all learn from Jennifer and your good work and the work of the Frameworks Institute, because, you know, that's something where the right conversation, I think, is devolved into a mess.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that, yes, on the one hand, Americans are cowboys. We're also barn raisers. That's also a really proud tradition we have.
Right.
And we just need to push forward the story of the barn raising and
sometimes
that accomplished.
The cowboys are the barn raisers.
That's
and vice
right.
versa.
They're
and
one
we don't
and
like
the
to.
Same.
Right, exactly.
That's right. That's right. We just need to push that story forward, help us see our collective interest in working together, and Framing can help us get there.
All right. Well, whether you're a cowboy or a barn raiser, you can learn a heck of a lot from the Frameworks Institute. And from Jennifer Nichols, who's been joining Melanie Piana and I. Jennifer's the Assistant Director of the Research Interpretation and Application at Frameworks. And again, they can go to your website at frameworksinstitute.org.
That's right.
And learn all about these things. And I think it'd be a fabulous thing to do, because we've all got a lot to learn about how we present ourselves and present our issues in society. So thank you, Melanie, for joining us again. Thank you, Jennifer, for being our guest. And we look forward to all of you listening to this, to checking out Frameworks. And it's certainly something that'll be worth your time. So appreciate you joining us again for the Economics of Place podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.